Et puis je vous propose donc de passer, mais vous pouvez rester, you can stay if you want. Donc nous avons une table ronde maintenant et j'appelle donc Inger Kari Nerheim de Norvège, Frank Whaley d'Écosse, Yam Ensi d'Irlande. So, thank you so much for coming. It's up to you if it's okay for you. Okay. Okay, so come on here. Is it okay?
Yes.
Okay.
You prefer to speak?
Okay. And donc nous allons, ce que je vous propose, nous allons entendre les trois présentations. On pose sans questions pour qu'on puisse avoir un temps d'échange important qui pourra revenir sur une des trois présentations ou des commentaires que vous pouvez faire sur l'ensemble des présentations. Donc c'est Monsieur Hennessy d'Irlande.
Bonsoir chacun. I should apologize to begin with. This presentation was intended to be made by my colleague and boss, Jim Ryan, but he is engaged in very difficult negotiations with our Ministry for Health about the national budget for mental health services next year in 2019, so he sends his apologies. So please allow me some latitude in what I'm saying. This is a quick overview of the Irish mental health services. I won't delay on it because it's just, as I say, a map of the Irish mental health services, and it's in these areas that we're trying to make changes. I suspect at this stage of the conference, people may be a little bit recovered out, so to speak, but the focus of my presentation is going to be on our national framework for recovery in Ireland, which stretches from 2018 to 2020. However, before I do that, and some of you may have heard me speak on Wednesday when I reported or gave you some information about a series of listening meetings we had in 2014, where we consulted with service users and family members throughout the country, over 1,000, in fact, turned up to those meetings, and these were the themes that emerged. And as you can see, I've identified in red the ones that I think are most relevant to this presentation. So developing respectful and empathetic relationships between all the stakeholders in our mental health services, and as Nigel said, through the wider communities. Service user family and carer involvement, and I spoke about that to some extent on Wednesday. I should say at this point that I am a service user. I have been since I was 17 and I'm now 64. So I have extensive experience of the Irish mental health services. And the third point identified in red there is providing continuity of care and supporting people in their recovery. And finally, and Nigel spoke about this as well, we are committed to providing peer support workers in our mental health services. So of those 10 themes identified by people who use the services in Ireland, those are the areas, I think, the items identified in red that are most relevant to recovery. We have a political and policy environment, and I won't go into some detail about that, but essentially, and I made the point on Wednesday that our national policy, A Vision for Change, which was promulgated in 2006, makes two specific recommendations very early on in the report. The first one I spoke about on Wednesday, that service users should be at the heart of the design, delivery, and evaluation of mental health services, and a core ethos or philosophy running through Vision for Change was that Irish mental health services should be based on the recovery model. So, what is the National Framework for Recovery in Ireland? It's a health service position on the development of recovery-oriented mental health services. It's a statement by the organisation that I work for, the Irish Health Service Executive, that recovery-oriented mental health services should be provided. It talks about, and Nigel spoke extensively, as did Sarah yesterday, about co-production. And finally, it attempts to ensure that a consistent, evidence-based and quality-focused services are delivered. So I like this little slide because it simplifies the many definitions we've seen now being put in place about recovery. And curiously, it kind of aligns with what Freud said a long time ago and also what the World Health Organization believes about good mental health and recovery, and that is to work, to love, and to play. So you can see there, recovery is somewhere to live, someone to love, and something to be. So in our National Recovery Framework, we have four principles: the centrality of lived experience, the co-production of services, organisational commitment to recovery, and that's a very important point that can't be emphasised enough. As Nigel pointed out, there is a danger with the recovery movement and the recovery philosophy that some services see it simply as window dressing. And finally, we need to support recovery in learning and practice in our services. So those are the four principles, and I'm going to talk a little bit about them, if I may. So principle one is the centrality of the lived experience, and we think this principle offers a unique insight because traditionally in the mental health services, the views of service users and their families about those services haven't been listened to or haven't been listened to sufficiently. It introduces new skills to our workforce, to the clinicians and service providers. It fosters hope and inspires recovery, and I think we've heard Nigel talk extensively about hope, and I couldn't agree more with the way he defined hope. It's about creating empathy and empowerment. It's about supporting service improvement with a recovery focus. So those are what it offers. Now, what are the key concepts of the first principle, the centrality of the lived experience? Well, obviously, the lived experience itself, the recovery experience, the demonstrable effect of recovery, and the creation of experts by experience. So I'm going to give some examples of recovery in action with each of the four principles. Just like other countries, like Scotland in particular, we're starting to roll out a cadre of peer support workers across all our services in the community and in the acute services. Wellness and recovery action planning is widely adopted now in the Irish mental health services as a way of managing an illness, as a way of, as was pointed out earlier on, as a way of living well, notwithstanding the illness. We have a national organisation that promotes recovery. It's called, the acronym is ARI, Advancing Recovery in Ireland. And we have the office that I lead, Mental Health Engagement. So the second principle is the co-production of services. And the key concepts of this principle are a parity of esteem. It's a national and local process. It's a process that has to work through the entire journey of the service user or the service provider. And it's about co-production. And co-production optimises resources, we believe, although You know, the proof of the pudding is always going to be in the eating, as I said on Wednesday. And it recognises service users and family members, carers' involvement in their own treatment and in the design of service as a strength, not as something to be endured or something to be put up with by service providers. The stakeholders in co-production, obviously service users, family members and carers, service providers, public sector agencies, after all they provide a lot of the money for the provision of services, and again in keeping with what Nigel mentioned, the critical role of the voluntary and community service, is that whole networking approach that was discussed so much in this conference. And just a fairly simple example of recovery in action, which relates directly to someone who is ill, that they have a real and meaningful role in their care and recovery planning. And in Ireland, care planning is individual care plans. There is a bit of, or there is a touch of the window dressing about them in our services. They can be tokenistic, and the level of involvement of the patient can be quite minimal. I know this from my own personal experience when I was in hospital one time, when I was simply handed a sheet of paper and said, "What are your goals?" And that was the end of my involvement in my care planning. I think this is, for me, actually, in rolling out a recovery framework, in rolling out a recovery philosophy, in rolling out a recovery model in our services, this is the most important principle, because without organisational commitment and that willingness to embrace change, recovery will not be embedded in our services. So we view recovery as actually a strategic approach to organisational change, and we're talking about huge cultural change here. We're talking about creating a recovery culture throughout our organisations, and I don't just mean the direct public health provision, but those voluntary and community organisations that I mentioned before. It's about the co-production of the design, delivery and evaluation of services, and that's a big leap for some service providers and policymakers to accept the meaningfulness and relevance of co-production. It's about communicating recovery values. It's about resourcing recovery. You have to put money into it. It just doesn't happen on its own. And it's about evaluating it, because as public servants, I think it's not unreasonable that we, when we adopt an approach, a way of caring for people and involving them in their care and treating them as equals, that we do actually evaluate it to see if it's working. So some examples of recovery in action as regards principle 3, the establishment of my office, the establishment of area and local forums across our mental health services for mental health engagement, and perhaps more immediate and more direct in terms of their potential impact, the promulgation of recovery framework in implementation plans. And because we're constrained by time, I'll just let you have a look at the 5 points there rather than go through them in detail. And again, just on the issue of evaluation, you'll see there the last bullet point, framework implementation will be included in national performance and monitoring. And finally, principle 4, supporting recovery learning and practice. So key concepts of the principle: a shared stakeholder understanding. All the parties need to understand what recovery is about, that it's about facilitating stakeholders, notwithstanding their mental health challenges, to live full and meaningful lives. And you need to develop recovery literacy around that. In other words, people need to know the alphabet of recovery. Again, in keeping what Nigel said, engaging experts by experience, peer support workers, and so forth. A commitment to co-production. Supports for stakeholders in their recovery role, and I'll talk a little bit about that in just a moment. And a recovery education strategy. We need to, as I said, enable people to be literate in recovery. So examples of recovery in action for this particular principle, supporting recovery learning and practice. We have recovery education plans, which we're rolling out amongst all stakeholders across the country. And for our clinical staff, for our doctors, nurses, occupational therapists, social workers, we have recovery principles and practices workshops, and they're pretty well attended. But I'd have to make the point that we'll only see the fruit of our labours in this regard as time goes on. So some challenges to implementation, the readiness of our organisation, whether it's actually ready to embrace the recovery model. And that's about cultural change, which I've touched on more than once in this presentation and indeed on Wednesday. It's about parity of esteem and valuing all contributions equally. It's a clear understanding of what co-production means in action, and that can be a difficult one. I think this is the most important item, really, the most important challenge. It needs leadership. People have to go out and, as it were, sell recovery, nail their colours to the mast of recovery. It's about positive risk management, and Nigel talked a little bit about that. And here we come to my bête noire, it's cultural change. It's about creating an environment where cultural change is possible. And those of you who heard me talk on Wednesday will see the little diagram, the clock on the right. Cultural change takes time, but you still have to keep pushing the stone up the hill. So, Míle Buíochas, which is Irish for mercy.
Up to you. Okay, so now the example from Norway, and we will finish with the example from Scotland. So you will begin and finish Scotland.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for the invitation. I've been so fortunate to hear about recovery work in France 1.5 years ago in Grenoble, which impressed me very much. And also this conference has given us a very good overview about a holistic way of meeting the mental distress and also mental health. And I congratulate you on that. I'm going to speak a little bit about an example, or three examples, and what to do when we're not Ireland. What to do when we don't have a national decision on top how to put recovery values into practice. And I must say, yes, we are transforming health systems in our country, and we're doing it step by step. Norway, we're moving around, maybe in some leaps, but also some of the steps are very small. As a conclusion, I think I would like to say, and this is my personal view from working with this since 2011, we are in the course of leaving behind the concept of user participation. We're changing the way we're speaking. In the national dialogue all across the country, we're leaving behind us the us and them. We're leaving behind the them, those patients, those groups of people. We're leaving behind us also the those professionals, those nurses, those kinds of staff. We're beginning to enter into a we. We're thinking very much about human rights. We think autonomy is intrinsic to the person. We think that's something that cannot be taken away from you, no matter how low your functioning is. I'm trying to get away from those words. No matter how out of tune you are with society, you still have your autonomy. You ask for help, but you're not giving away your autonomy. You're just asking for help. So we're we're working with the meaning in life for everybody. We're working on individual choice, on creating my identity, even when I'm ill, even when I'm out of tune with how people usually act. I'm me. Being part of one's community as part of defining myself, that's some of the things we're talking about. And they are just as important as high-quality treatment, evidence-based service systems. We need the scientific understanding of these things. We also need the scientific understanding of how do we create mental ill health and how do we create mental good health. And now when we've been working in this way across the country, we meet people in the services and outside services all the time. We ask ourselves, how could we not have asked the patients, is this really helping you, what we're doing, this plan we have? No, we've been saying, oh no, but you know, you can't ask them. They're so ill, they wouldn't know. We better, and we take upon ourselves the big responsibility of making the choices for other people. And where was our sense of urgency in all those years when we were working to create good services? Because we were actually treating people into poverty. We were treating them into loneliness. We let them stay in our very good wards, and they lost contact with their friends. One said, first I lost my friends, then I lost my job, then I lost my family, and I think I lost me. But we thought, no, it's the illness. They're so ill, and it's so severe. But maybe it was also the treatment, some of it anyway. Our treatment, and we had the best of intentions, really. But why didn't we ask? That might have changed it. Well, in our hospital in Stavanger, we actually did. We did what they do in on the subway in England, in London, and we have this checklist and those comments, and I read those as director of the service. Every month I got the printouts, and 20% said, this was hell. And 20% said, thank you, you saved my life. None of those things were really good, but we really didn't act on it either. But we tried to improve ourselves. And when we began with these ideas, we really had a lot in place. We had early intervention. I mean, in Norway, we were one of the instigators of the TIPS project. And we had housing first, broadly. And we had individual placement and support. We knew that people needed jobs. And two of our wards even had peer support and recovery thinking. We had fact teams, act teams, all of this. And we had open dialogue. I hope you're using open dialogue. But still, there was no actual transformation. All over Norway in this period from 1998 to 2010, there were great laws coming into place, great documents like the patient first. Our different health ministers made speeches to the services and said, you must listen to the patients. And actually, they told us, you're doing a lousy job, especially the hospitals. Communities, we have hope in them. I'm caricaturing a little. These were lots of great people, our Directorate of Health, lots of wonderful psychiatrists and nurses sitting there making these great documents, co-produced with user organizations, doing user participation on the systems level. We did a lot on the systems level. On the individual level, well, so-so. Hell on earth, yes, or not so good. Or it was in spite of the treatment that I got out of this. So I'm going to tell you two examples from communities who did something really well. And like we just heard from Liam Hennessy, the organizational commitment was there in both communities. And there was funding, and they did it and all. We'll see some more of that. Then from my hospital and my project, the Pathfinder project, we lacked a lot of that. Still, we've done something. I'll show you that. Then I have interviewed 5 people from research and government and services during the last weeks preparing for this talk to hear, is it really as bad as I'm going to say? And you'll see afterwards. And then a little bit about where to go from here. So the Bergen community. Have you heard of Bergen? At Hansa City, it's the second largest in Norway. Beautiful. It rains every other day because it's filled with mountains. And there was a person there who in 1993 took a team of co-workers doing social work in the city to a conference in the rehabilitation sector, WAPR. And they got an aha feeling. I don't know if you get that, have that expression. And they now have 35 employees with lived experience. It's better than France, isn't it? Oh, sorry. I was impolite. It's at least better than Stavanger. And they created a teaching program for peer support that was university-based. Now they're making also a recovery college. They have a user panel with 20 users who comment on every decision in Bergen community which has to do with people's mental health. So the politicians and bureaucrats can't just sit there and talk. Neither can the people in the services. They do collaborate with research, and they've been followed by some good researchers in Norway. And they have this joint understanding of recovery. They collaborate with the user organizations, and they have this ongoing reflection that we've been hearing today also with some of you here and in the debates, this ongoing reflection. It might be the most important thing that they're doing, is this ongoing. But the city council supported this small group of professionals and clinicians and users who started this, bureaucrats also. And through all those years, they've been working together on every sector. There's a public commitment. If you look at their websites and you're a young adult, you'll see in 2 or 3 pages, you will see, if you do not know where you're going in life, our people will help you with your self-help plans and find your goals in life so that we ensure that we're helping you with what you need. Now let's go 5 hours drive south and 5 ferries to Sandnes community, a small city in the Stavanger-Sandnes area. It has under 100,000 inhabitants. Their recovery story began in 2012. Now, in that shorter time, they've trained all the staff in the mental health and addiction services, and they did this very early on. They had discussion groups. They discussed, what is this recovery thing? Is it something for us? And they made a commitment in 2013 that this is what they were going to do. And they have a training program together with Tilburg University in the Netherlands where they actually give patients who come from the specialist service and are discharged, they give them a course in how to handle your own recovery. And those people, they don't much go back to hospital. They're out there living their lives. Maybe they go to an outpatient service. They have now 12 employees with lived experience, and they're establishing a recovery college. Just happened 2 months ago. They use open dialogue in treatment. And every service asks, what matters to you? What is important to you? This was also a story about professionals with commitment, bureaucrats in the community with commitment, politicians who said yes, they got the necessary funding, and the public knows about it. They know that they're doing something new in mental health and addiction services in our community, and they're proud. So what was happening in our hospital at the same time? We had a small pilot in one of the district centers I don't know if it was a coincidence that it was in Sunday's community. Maybe it was, but it was the specialist service. Oh, yes. There were 22 inpatients. There had been inpatients that got this... there were 30 patients who got this service. Instead of being inpatients, they could come every day to a room, a place to be, where they got a recovery-based program. And the year they began, these patients altogether had 776 overnight stays in the hospital or in the district center's wards. After two years, they were down to 441 days, and the amount of days that were voluntary had increased. It was interesting. So we said, okay, let's try this in another district psychiatric center, too. There we closed down four beds. There was an uproar. But the service improved because some of those hotel costs overnight being taken care of at night were turned into positions for professionals, for nurses, doctors, and psychologists. And so actually each of these patients that got help in this district psychiatric center saw more resources afterwards because we didn't use the money to keep them in beds. We began planning a recovery project, which ended up into being the Pathfinder project. And we had a grand design. I mean, we thought it was as good as Imrock's plans. But we met in the organization resistance. It was surprising. I'd been leading this, one of the organizations, for 15 years. And I thought we were going the same way. The chief psychiatrist said, Inger Kari, this is going to tear down everything we've been working for. It's a very serious allegation. There were so many people already pushing in this direction. So we went that way. But we had to do it in another, not the way we had planned, with a systematic project, with a project grant. We had to find ways around that. So some of the people in our hospital said, we're already doing all of this. But very many said, and some came like Nicodemus in the night and said, how soon can we start? So we planned, we did literature search, we did site visits, the board of directors went to IMROC, and we did a thorough assessment of what are the success factors. How do you become recovery supportive in a hospital service, and what were the easiest, cheapest success factors? We looked at countries where they've been doing this for many, many years. I mean, go to UK, go to, yes, Australia, New Zealand, and now Ireland. And we created a recovery forum. The recovery forum was an open invitation. If you worked in a community, if you worked in community service, if you worked in hospitals, if you were a user or carer, welcome. Everybody came. And this was a group that then worked, met every other month for 1.5 years, and they agreed. The key factors that we wanted to have in place in our area were training for all staff. They had to know what is this recovery thing. And they had to get access to peer support. But the peer support had to be safe, safe for the peer. How do you share your story in a way that it gives hope? How do you make it safe for the patient who gets a peer support? How do you make it safe for the colleagues that all of a sudden are not getting a trained person used to assess violence risk, etc.? And how is it safe for the leader? So you need training for peer support and a good employment structure. And we needed the self-help tools. We needed wellness plans. We don't call them recovery action plans. It's more like a life plan, and we needed advanced support and crisis plans. And we wanted supported decision-making. What these talks gave us, and the literature search and visits, that we had to find out what is true north. What was going to be our compass to be sure that we were going to be recovery focused, that we were going to be recovery supportive, that everything we did along the way also was true to recovery values? We were not going to point at people with arrows and say, oh, you're not good enough. We're going to say, welcome, let's support everybody who's on the way. And we found that, among other places, in a briefing paper from the Scottish Recovery Network called Connecting Rights and Recovery in Mental Health. It's excellent. You'll find it on their website. It connected the recovery ideas from the CHIME paper that Liam told us about, and Nigel, what works for recovery, to the Convention for the Rights of People with Disabilities, to the important factors in how we understand each other as human beings. So we decided that to be true, to keep true to what we had been fascinated by, we needed to really learn more about the human rights perspective. We needed to stay true to the civil rights approach. And actually, when I think about this and thought about going to France, I was thinking about the ideas of liberty and brotherhood that's in your constitution. I thought, well, France must be a great way for celebrating autonomy for the person seeking help in mental health. But then when we went on this route, we thought, how can we be satisfied with these small steps when the values of recovery and the solutions actually are there in the Convention for the Rights of People with Disabilities? I mean, Norway, we took 6 years to ratify it after we'd signed the original one. And it's embarrassing to think about. So where were we when the patients needed us to be their champions? We were doing business as usual and being obedient civil servants and listening to our boss. No, this budget, no. So what's wrong with us, we thought. So into our fervor and the fun of doing this and all the interesting reflections we had, there grew a dissatisfaction and maybe also an anger. I'm not going to say it's gone. We created a network project. Okay, so my boss said, Inger Kari, when you're leaving your job to do this project, you must know we're not funding you. We're just funding your position. The project will have to get exterior funding. So we decided that gave us freedom. Nobody could much decide what we did, but everybody who wanted to contribute would own everything that we produced in the project. So it was quite fun, actually. We had an awareness of urgency, and this recovery forum said, let's just do it. And we said, since it took so long time to decide on the project decision design, we had an idea. Let's just begin with the most important stuff. So people worked on their free time making the self-help plans, the crisis plan, and after a year, when we did get the project through, we had these two books. And we had lots of committed users. And we did get a steering committee, which was formally designed and with both of the hospitals joining us on board, plus all the communities and the unions. So we had learned from lateral thinking, what if we didn't wait for funding either? So we didn't. And we looked around for resources. And one of the people who had been working with us said, well, I think we need, it was a course for training, and he said, do you mind if I come here at 7:15 in the morning? And so he came and started working full time. And then a friend came And a couple came, and then we were 10 to 15 people. In the last 2.5 years, we've had 10 to 15 people coming in and doing the project work that we otherwise would not have been able to do. So, how to transform our systems? We think that this has, the recovery way of thinking, coupled with autonomy, has such a strength in it. It has an inner force that if we don't join in and do it, I think we'll have some internal disruption in our services. And rather, let's just join up. Because the services, our patients say, we need services. Hey, I need treatment. You're not going to close down the services, are you? We need all that good help. But we also need to be an I who meets a you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So directly to Scotland, from Norway to Scotland, it's not so, it's a long journey.
Hello, my name is Frank Riley. I am a human being, just like you are also human beings. And standing in front of you with these lights on me, I feel very vulnerable as a human being. So I invite you to be part of that vulnerability. I'm also standing in front of my boss, who's Nigel Henderson, who has spoken about many of the things I would have spoken about today. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you through the history of the transformation of Scottish mental health over the next 20 minutes or so. And what I'm going to talk about is what was done, why we did it, and what we learned, and at the end I'll suggest perhaps there are some key lessons that perhaps the French system can learn from what we did. So the starting point in Scotland is a difficult one. I'm not going to give you all of the statistics, and I will mention this in a couple of minutes. But through the 1970s, we had significant rise in mental health problems in Scotland. We always have had higher rates of mental illness than in England, their nearby neighbour, as I'm sure you're aware. And from 1978 onwards, we had 4 times an increase in suicide in young men. But we also had no significant mental health reform since 1960, until fairly recently, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that. Now, this diagram actually is a diagram of the underground system within Glasgow, and it demonstrates one of the other significant challenges that we have in Scotland around physical health as well as mental health. And within Glasgow, there are 2 areas, and between those 2 areas, there is a 15-year gap in life expectancy. So in the south part of Glasgow, 63 is life expectancy, and in the north part of Glasgow, it's 78. We have a whole range of things that are challenging our health services and our communities over the next wee while. And mental health is a major part of all of that transformation. So before 1998, and 1998 is an important year in terms of Scottish development, and I'll tell you a bit more about that. 1998, before that point in time, Scotland had a number of things that happened to it. There was deindustrialisation. We had a whole series of governments that weren't reflecting how Scottish population had voted. We also appeared to be a place where our Conservative government at that particular point were testing out new ways of doing things, particularly taxes. So we had the poll tax imposed on us before it was in the rest of the UK. So there was a sense within Scotland that we were a country or a place where we felt that things were being done too. So what happened next? In 1998, we had devolution. We had control over our local politics. So rather than the UK government making decisions about key parts of our public policy and the running of our services, we had greater local control. And there was a rise, a feeling of optimism within the country during that particular point. Now, I think that this is where we began to look at radical transformation of our health services, of our mental health services and our community services, and a greater feeling of optimism. Now, prior to 1998 and 1997, we had a framework for mental health, which was established. We had a fund called the Mental Health Development Fund. We had the Scottish Development Centre for Mental Health was established. And we had an overarching group called the Mental Health Reference Group, which oversaw any of the developments in mental health in Scotland. Now, the reason I'm mentioning these things is clearly where you're at in terms of your development, there are quite significant things that you feel that you need to do. And I think it's important to show you that we went through quite significant structural changes in Scotland before we got to the place we are just today. So do we have a common starting point with our UK neighbours? I do feel as a Scots person it's really important to say we are Scottish. We happen to be in the UK, but we're Scottish. And we don't have the same starting point as our other neighbours within the United Kingdom. We do have philosophical differences, and I can point back to the 18th century, and our philosophical differences are quite distinct. So we have quite significant thinkers from Scotland during the Scottish Enlightenment who tended to talk about common sense philosophy, what makes best sense for your local community, and a sense of democratising knowledge, whereas the thinkers down in England, Jeremy Bentham, J.S. Mill, etc., were talking about a specialisation of knowledge. Now, that's important because that's the bedrock of how we begin to look at what's important for our local community services and why it's important to democratise and to ensure that we have some connection with community as a direct result. So underlying some of those thoughts were this sense of connection within Scottish society in the 18th century. It's not that different today, although some of that element of connection has been eroded over time. And the importance of community to how we feel about ourselves and other people. That was central to Scottish thinking. And I think it's central to the Scottish sense of being. And I think it's really interesting looking back at some of these quotes. Again, looking at the 18th century, where there was a well-developed sense of human mutual obligation. Now, clearly in terms of recovery orientation and some of the things we've talked about today in terms of peer support, that is one of the key elements of it. And I think within Scottish society, that's what we've built on over the last wee while. So in 1998, we achieved an element of devolution. We had our own parliament. And it's important to say, particularly with Brexit on the horizon, that interwoven in that devolution settlement was the European Convention on Human Rights. So we had the Human Rights Act, which was interwoven into the devolution settlement, not only for Scotland, but also for Ireland, Northern Ireland as well. And what that means in actual fact is that there is no physical way, no possible way that the Scottish Parliament can pass laws that are contrary to the Human Rights Act, that are contrary to the European Convention on Human Rights. Now, that differs from the UK Parliament, who can actually pass laws that contradict the Human Rights Act. And a judge can say, well, actually, that you shouldn't do that. And the Parliament can decide whether or not to go forward or not. So interwoven in Scottish society, now I would argue, is this underlying feeling that human rights are at the centre of what we do. And Nigel mentioned quite a lot of that earlier on in his presentation. So there is a marked, significant change in direction in the legislation within the UK and within Scotland. Prior to 1996, 1997, there was a greater sense of a deficit model in terms of our legislative structure from the Scotland Act, Social Work Scotland Act 1968, right through to 1985. And there is a break when the Human Rights Act come into play, where it's much more about enablement legislation, enabling greater involvement of people in controlling their own lives. And there were other key actions. We began to review our Mental Health Act in quite considerable detail. And that began with the Milan Committee in 2001 and was overseen by the National Programme in 2001 as well. And it led to the Mental Health Care and Treatment Act in 2003. So what did that act actually do? Well, it talked about three particular key elements: reciprocity, which I have a quote here which will tell you exactly what that means. Where society imposes an obligation on an individual to comply with a programme of care, it should also impose a parallel obligation on the health and social care authorities to provide safe and appropriate services, including ongoing care following discharge from compulsion. So there's a requirement within all of our services that if you take some liberties away, for whatever reason, that you hold that person in the most appropriate place and return that liberty as soon as possible, but within the least restrictive environment. So it should be the last possible, compulsory care should be the last resort. So the core principles underlying the Act and what we did thereafter, Nigel's already mentioned nothing about us without us, and so has Liam. It's one of the key principles underlying what we try to do within Scotland. And consultation and engagement was, and it still remains, and should still remain, core to the entire process. The diagram on the left comes from the National Standards for Community Engagement, which is actually very rarely referred to these days, but was core to how we began to think about how we engage with communities as professionals and how we made their voices heard within policy and development of our services. Now, there is an artificial distinction here that we have, and I've already mentioned it earlier on. I'm a human being and you're a human being. That's the thing that we have in common. And that was always a bit of a challenge when it came to consultation and engagement, where professionals would take their higher view rather than recognising that they were also part of that community. And I'll come back and mention that later. Then in 2004, my own organisation came into being, funded and developed as a result of part of the National Programme for Mental Health. And our intentions were to take recovery concepts, build on evidence bases from other countries, and make adaptations so that we could implement recovery right across systems. So this was a joint effort, not just from organisations within the health service, but third sector organisations, and in partnership with people who had been through services themselves, carers, and those who possibly weren't in services at that particular point, but had some key points to share with us. And our starting point was a narrative project. We've heard quite a lot over the last couple of days of quantitative materials from psychiatrists and pharmacologists. Our interest was in people's stories of change and how that they reframed their stories. And our purpose was to engage with communities across Scotland to debate how best to promote and support recovery for long-term mental health. We now talk about applying those principles right across the domain of mental ill health, so it's not simply about long-term mental health anymore. And we, through that narrative exchange, we became much more aware of, we had more evidence that recovery is more than the mere absence of symptoms, and it's a deeply personal process. So having one definition probably doesn't suit many people because it's something that belongs to you as an individual. And we began to promote and support recovery as part of one of the four key aims of the then Scottish Executive's National Programme for Improving Mental Health and Wellbeing. And the things that were helping us make that break and make that leap forward has already been mentioned by some of the previous speakers. Looking to peer as a process, as a mechanism for changing services, for enabling professionals to recognise the power of having somebody who'd had lived experience as part of their services. Now, within statutory services, we expected that opportunity to be taken up much more readily, but it has been predominantly in third sector organisations. So Penumbra, for example, has the most, I suspect, peers within Scotland. On average, we've got about 83 in total in Scotland. And yesterday, Sarah Rose mentioned 800 in England. I think Nigel and I were talking about it yesterday. It's probably an equivalent in terms of the overall population that we have in Scotland. And the other thing we began to look at, which Carrie mentioned and also Liam earlier on, was the empowering tools that were available. RAP was one of them. We took RAP and made our own version of it, and we created communities that were self-supporting around RAP, and they now continue to do RAP on their own. They're not reliant upon us. And we have a similar project which looks at writing as a mechanism for reframing life and beginning to take control and to recognise the strengths and recovering and having survived the adversity that our communities can experience. But the important thing from that was about being able to create resources that were available within communities that weren't necessarily things that were exclusively delivered by professional services. Now, one of the things that we did influence quite significantly was training for mental health professionals. So this rights, relationships and recovery document speaks to training for nurses in particular, which came out in 2006, and it placed recovery right at the centre of nurse training, and there's been knock-on effects as a direct result of that. So we began to look at how we would influence the NHS structures and the social care structures over time. And we did put a lot of effort into that. So what happened then? Services began to adopt the recovery language. There was some evidence of change. We had a tool that was capturing some of that. Peer support became more important than it had been. But the release of power from services came slowly. And the deficits language, these are the things that you cannot do, remained very much so in services, although it didn't occur quite so much, if at all, actually, in third sector, who were still pursuing the recovery agenda. And in 2008, we had the crash. We all had the crash. It affected some countries worse than others, and it had a significant impact. The narrative changed. Co-production became prominent and began to be, as an alternative to what Liam was describing, it began to be viewed as a means to deliver services as opposed to something that you would do along with other people. And some services began to be rebadged as recovery without what we would recognise as having significant change. And we found that using the tools that we had, services were able to meet the letter of recovery, but possibly not the spirit of recovery. And funds began to dwindle. And there was also a backlash. This is a graphic from a group called Recovery in the Bin, who were reacting against some of the changes that they saw that were impacting upon them. So I think there was a sense of sequestration where recovery was being taken by services to mean something completely different. And there is a worry, and there's still a worry, that if co-production is sequestered in that way, in what way was recovery being sequestered in that picture there? One of the key comments that tended to be said around co-production was, we need to do more with less. This is a perpetual motion machine from Italy. It doesn't work. Doing more with less doesn't work either, funnily enough. So what we've done over the last while is we began to look at how we move away from trying to influence services. We still have that dialogue, but think about communities in a wider sense, and that includes the professionals who are working with them, seeing it as an ecosystem, beginning to look at the interrelationships between professionals and the places they're working, focusing on the importance of connection, learning from what works, and creating diversity as much as possible. Single models, our experience would suggest, have a short lifespan. Continual development is one of the things that we're looking for to create sustainability. I don't have time to talk about that. So what does co-production and recovery tell us? Doing with, not to, is pretty central. Sharing experiences, whether you're a professional or you're somebody receiving service, is equally important. It's important we start to normalise the experience of distress. Mental health is not 1 in 4 in our country. Distress affects 100% of our population. It'll affect 100% of us in this room. It's one of the things we as humans have in common. Let's not make those divisions that we tend to do. Our purpose is trying to create and maintain sustainability within our communities and realising, given what our philosophical background has been, it's not new. It's a different way of thinking, but it's not new. So what we're doing now is we're celebrating what works. We're looking to try and democratise knowledge as much as possible. We're looking to try and empower communities, whether those are communities of expertise and professional groups or communities in geographical sense. We're trying to learn from liberation movements. And longer term, my organisation should be redundant. We shouldn't be required. And that's our longer term goal, is to make ourselves redundant. So what are the lessons that I can give you today? Key thing from our journey is that legislation and values with human rights must be at the centre, and it's certainly, I believe, been one of the things that have driven change within Scotland. Investment that's not sustainable, you should stop. Investment must be sustainable, because as soon as you take that investment away, then it changes the nature of the dialogue, and it can make people go back to their core business. For some health services, that might be big white buildings and people in white coats, rather than what they should be doing, which is looking at devolving to local communities. Experimentation is risky, but it's definitely worth it. Vested interests are much stronger than you think and takes time to undermine. But nevertheless, anything set in stone will eventually crumble. And I'll leave you with one quote. Sorry, I'm over my time. Knowledge emerges only through invention and reinvention, through restless, impatient, continuing, hopeful inquiry human beings pursue in the world, with the world and with each other. And that's the philosophy that we take forward within SRN, and hopefully will influence our Scottish society to do so also. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Donc merci à toutes les personnes qui sont intervenues.